My featured musical this evening is a 70th anniversary tribute to Love Life, which was billed as a vaudeville. It had music by Kurt Weill, book and lyrics by Alan J. Lerner, and it opened on the 46th Street Theatre in New York on October the 7th, 1948, where it ran for 252 performances. The score of Love Life hasn't been recorded complete to date, so we shall be featuring a compilation of recordings on tonight's program, including songs especially recorded for this broadcast by my special studio guest, Michael Levine.
Hello, Rob.
Good evening, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
But first of all, to introduce the musical, it's my very great pleasure to welcome to the program, via telephone from Los Angeles, the distinguished musical theatre historian, archivist and author, Miles Kruger. Good evening, Miles.
Well, good evening, Rob. After an introduction like that, you improved my posture.
Glad to hear
it. Which is very kind of you.
Well, not only did you see the original production of Love Life back in 1948, but you're also intimately involved with its author, Alan J. Lerner.
Yes, that's certainly true. I was a theater and English major at Bard College from 1950 to 1954, and by 1955... I was out looking for work on Broadway. There was almost, it's hard to believe today, but there was almost no off-Broadway movement at that time yet. It was developing, but it hadn't really flowered. There was the Circle in the Square and the Provincetown Playhouse for rent, and basically that was the off-Broadway movement. So if you loved the theater, as I did, it was Broadway or nothing.
Yes.
And I can hardly explain... Except I have to. I'm working on my memoirs, so I have to learn to explain how within about 1 year, and not longer than that, I became mentored miraculously by Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Alan J. Lerner, Fritz Lowe, Harold Arlen, Yip Harburg, all the people whose work I adored as I was growing up. They just welcomed me into their lives.
Very good company indeed to be in.
Well, it was a miracle, absolutely a miracle. And I found that Rodgers and Hammerstein's office had copies of scripts of all the shows, or not all, but almost every show that Rodgers had written with Lorenz Hart.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the librarian there if I could come in after a program I was working on aired literally on my birthday, March 28th, 1955. So, starting in April, I began to go to the R&H office and read scripts. And Rodgers came in, and he would say hello to me every day, although he had no idea who I was. I was just some young person reading scripts.
Yes.
And finally, one day I went in, and the librarian said, Mr. Rodgers would like to see you. And I thought, oh, gosh, I'm being sent to the headmaster's office. I'll never be able to read all these scripts.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me tell you, within 15 or 20 minutes, Richard Rodgers, who was not just a composer, he was the emperor of Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
He had a role that no one probably since Victor Herbert had had on Broadway as a symbolic figure for the essence of Broadway. He controlled so much more than just his own scores.
Yes.
Richard Rodgers gave me, as a gift, the day I met him, copies of all the Rodgers and Hart shows that he had in the office. And this was before photocopying existed.
Yes.
And he said, if we have three or more copies, you can have one. If we have one or two copies, you can borrow it and take it home. Oh. And it was a miracle.
Indeed.
Just an absolute miracle.
Uh-huh.
And then that same year, in 1955, I went to work for Herman Levin at 424 Madison Avenue, above Chock Full of Nuts, that heavenly coffee. And Herman Levin was producing a Broadway musical to be written by Fritz Lowe and Alan J. Lerner.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was going to be a musical version of Shaw's Pygmalion. And my big task was to accept resumes and 8x10s and things like that. And so we had dancers who can carry a tune and actors who can hum a little bit, you know, there's various categories.
Yes.
And Lerner and Lowe were off in the summer of 1955 writing a little trifle that ended up as My Fair Lady.
Indeed.
And I remember going to Downey's, where all the young actors used to go, and sitting in a booth with a friend, having a beer, and he said, "What are you working on?" I said, "Oh, it's a musical version of Shaw's Pygmalion." And he jabbed me in the ribs with his elbow. And he said, "What's it going to be, another chocolate soldier?" Which, of course, was based on Arms in the Sand. I was embarrassed to mention that I was working on this thing called My Fair Lady. And then one day, Lerner and Lowe, whom I had not met before, because they were off writing the score, came into the office, and they sang six songs. And I remember standing there in the corner thinking, this isn't so bad. This is pretty good.
Indeed.
I think I was right.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then Alan decided that I looked exactly like what he was conceiving as Freddie Eynsford Hill. I was pencil thin. I looked like an English schoolboy with black hair cascading over my forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Do you know the role of Freddie?" I said, "Of course I do." He said, "Well, you know, there's a song that I wrote called On the Street Where You Live."
Mm-hmm.
And the music isn't composed yet. Fritz is going to compose it to the voice of whoever plays the part.
Oh.
And he wants it to crest at an A, which is pretty high. Can you hit an A? And I said, "Oh, sure. I'm a high tenor. I sang tenor solo in Messiah at Bard College. I played Richard in Ruddigore. He hits A's all over the place. I can do that."
Yes.
And so Fritz came into the office a few days later, and with me standing beside the piano, he composed On the Street Where You Live.
Oh, quite an honor.
And I sang it, and it was the first time anyone in the world heard that song. And I just didn't feel that I was ready, technically, or probably even emotionally, to play on Broadway 8 times a week, you know?
Yes, yes.
So I kept turning it down and turning it down, and they finally hired Michael King, Dennis King's son.
Indeed.
Who was fully 10 years older than I.
Yes.
I was the right age. I was the right age to be Freddie.
Yes.
But Michael knew what he was doing, and he became my best friend in the cast, I think.
Oh, great, great. So you're the first member of the public to hear On the Street Where You Live.
Well, yes. I mean, I remember Mossy was in the office. Moss Hart was there, and Herman Levin was there, and Alan was there, and each had a separate little office within the suite, within Herman Levin's suite, and each came out of his respective door and stood into the main section of the office, which had a big piano.
Yes.
And Fritz was at the piano when I sang it, and he said, Fritz said, "Good." He said, "Now sing it very, very quietly."
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a Viennese professor. "Sing it very quietly." So I sang it very quietly.
Yes.
And then he said, "Good, now sing it in the biggest voice you have." And I said, "But Fritz, I'll disturb everybody." He said, "Good, disturb them all." So I sang it in my biggest voice, and everybody came out, and they heard this brand new song, On the Street Where You Live.
Oh, great. Well, going back to Love Life, this was the musical done without Fritz Lowe, but with Kurt Weill. And it came after Brigadoon between Lerner and Lowe.
Well, it did. Actually, Fritz hated bothering writing. some artists love to do their work. You know, some people who are writers can't stop writing, even if nobody publishes what they write. Fritz hated it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He always found an excuse to retire. And so Brigadoon was a hit. That was enough for him. So he went into a temporary retirement. Same thing happened in 1951 after Paint Your Wagon.
Yes.
And then certainly after Camelot. He just wanted to have a nice love nest in Palm Springs, which he had. And, you know, he didn't need to work. And it seems odd that a man as gifted as Fritz was just had such a small catalogue completed works, really.
But I guess he could well and truly retire on the royalties from My Fair Lady et al.
Well, yes, I would say so. But that wasn't really the point. He just liked living in calm and luxury and, you know, with pretty girls all around. That's what he told me. He made it very clear. I remember standing in the back of the Hellinger one day when My Fair Lady was on. I used to go all the time, even though I wasn't playing Freddie.
Yes.
And Fitz said, oh, I'm going to retire after this.
Uh-huh.
And it was an effort to get him to do Camelot.
Indeed. And how did Kurt Vile come into the picture? I believe that he and Alan J. Lerner were neighbours on the Hudson River, was it?
Yes. Well, Kurt Vile had a house with Lenya on in New City, which is on the west side of the Hudson,
yes,
across from Westchester County. South Mountain Road is the name of the actual street. I've been there many times. And but it was Cheryl Crawford, really, who glued the two of them together.
Mm-hmm.
Cheryl had produced Brigadoon and helped worked, you know, with Kurt Weill.
Yes.
And One Touch of Venus. And so she was the glue that really brought the two of them together. She was a remarkable producer, well ahead of her time, talking about, you know, women in leading roles or in roles of power. Cheryl Crawford was indeed a pioneer in that world.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And she always had very good taste. She picked the best people. I mean, Kurt Weill, Lerner, Kazan, directing his second musical, and he had earlier directed Kurt Weill's One Touch of Venus. Those are the only two musicals he ever did on Broadway.
Yes.
And Michael Kidd, fresh from
Finian's Rainbow.
From Finian's Rainbow, yes. Yeah. And my gosh, who could be better than Boris Aronson for the sets, Lucinda Ballard for costumes? I mean, it was a remarkable group of people.
Indeed.
And then wonderfully cast with Nanette Fabre and Ray Middleton.
Mm-hmm.
And Nan was a very, very dear friend of mine. She just passed away very recently. And she had a superb singing voice, but it's hard to tell because most of the shows in which she appeared didn't require a superb singing voice, you
yeah.
know?
Yes.
I mean, Papa, Won't You Dance With Me could be sung by practically any pop singer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the biggest song people had heard her sing up to that time
yes.
on Broadway in High Button Shoes.
Indeed. And this was something of a departure, too. I guess it was one of the first of the so-called concept musicals, along with Rodgers and Hammerstein's Allegro, in that it wasn't really naturalistic action, but, well, this was presented in the form of a vaudeville show, which commented on the action.
Well, Alan was always very cynical about things and certainly managed to destroy 7 or 8 marriages. I think 7 were destroyed, and I think it was the 8th one that survived, although I think I lost track somewhere along the line. And already had one divorce behind him when he wrote Love Life.
Yes.
He was then married to Marion Bell, who had been the leading lady of Brigadoon, of course, and later became a dear friend of mine when I moved to California. She lived out here.
Yes.
And it's a somewhat mordant, satiric comment on how contemporary values in society alter the personal lives of the average American. That's what the show is about.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And he probably could have told the same story by presenting different married couples over the years, instead of one married couple, the Coopers, who never aged nor changed physically from 1791 until the present day, or until 1948 when the show opened.
Yes.
The point is that it's not about the Coopers. It's about the issue of how relationships are altered by the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a thrilling, fresh, adventurous idea. Brooks Atkinson, the most influential newspaper critic of the time, because he was with the New York Times for decades, just never got the point.
Yes.
Nor did he ever get the point of Pow Joey.
Oh.
I mean, Brooks Atkinson was a sort of staid standard bearer.
Yes.
He was a very good writer, very reliable, but it was difficult for him to cope with innovative theater forms and theater styles. And unfortunately, it didn't matter that most of the other reviews were positive, because the Times is what indicated whether a show would become a success or a failure.
Yes.
And still is today, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That... there are fewer newspapers today than there were then.
Yes.
But Atkinson did not help. And the second thing that did not help was that wretched man, James Petrillo, the head of the Musicians Union, who called a musician's strike, his second, by the way, in 1948.
Yes.
And no records were made with instrumentalists. So there was no cast recording of Villa-Lobos' Magdalena, which had a glorious score with lyrics by Wright and Forrest.
Mm-hmm.
There was no cast album of Frank Lesser's first Broadway show, Where's Charlie?
Indeed.
There was no cast album of Sigmund Romberg's operetta, My Romance with Anne Jeffries.
Yes.
And certainly Love Life as well. And the miracle is that Kiss Me, Kate managed to open so late in 1948, December 30th, that all they had to do was to wait a few days and record it on the first available Sunday in 1949,
uh-huh.
or that we wouldn't have a cast recording of Kiss Me, Kate. Can you imagine?
Indeed, yes. Although the cast did reassemble to do a stereo recording in the mid-50s too, so we have that as well as the original Broadway cast.
Yes, but and there were singles that were the musicians and the Broadway community fought a little bit. Inside USA had an album that's a sort of quasi cast album on RCA Victor.
Yes.
Knowing there was going to be a strike, on the day prior to the strike, RCA Victor brought in Jack Haley and Bee Lilly to record their songs from Inside USA. And then they filled out the rest of the score, including the big love song, by the way, that's a Schwartz and Dietz musical, with Perry Como's recording of Haunted Heart, which was the big love song from that show.
Indeed.
And so that's not a cast performance, but it's a quasi-cast album. And Ray Bolger, who was supposed to head a whole cast album of Where's Charlie, did, as you must know, a single of Once in Love with Amy and Make a Miracle with Aline McLeary, who just passed away also a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as the girls go, Bobby Clark recorded two songs, again, on Victor from As the Girls Go. But there would have been a full cast album had the Petrillo person not instigated these wretched strikes.
Indeed, yes.
And during World War II, when you would want for morale all the latest songs with the biggest stars, not just for the people on the so-called home front, but for the soldiers fighting in the trenches. Petrillo had a ban that lasted from 1942 into 1944, and only Decca individually as a label signed with the AFM. And if he thought he was helping the musicians professionally, Petrillo was doing a terrible thing. He virtually killed off the big band era.
Mm, indeed, yes, it sounds like it.
They all depended on phonograph records for their success, and there were none, whatever.
Exactly. Yes, I recall hearing an album by Bing Crosby, I think, of a song from Oklahoma recorded about 1943, and they have an a cappella harmony group harmonizing in the background, but no instrumentation.
Yes, and all the
whatsoever.
Songs from Higher and Higher, sung by Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
I Couldn't Sleep a Wink Last Night, and songs like that, were all accompanied by a humming chorus, which is grotesque. And President Roosevelt personally interceded and asked Petrillo to ban the ban, as it were, that morale required it.
Yes.
Petrillo was intransigent. He would not change his mind.
Yeah.
It was a disgrace, truly a disgrace.
Indeed. So as our friend Peter Felicia says, that many Broadway musicals survive by their original cast albums. It keeps it in the public eye and in the public domain, so to speak, and people become familiar with the scores through their original cast recordings. So that
well,
was...
of course they do. Mm. And that's why so many of the shows I just mentioned, except for Where's Charlie, ran maybe 3 months.
Mm.
And they would have run clearly longer because they were good shows. I saw every single one of them. Mm. And, I'd been going to the theater by 1948 for 10 years because I saw my first show when I was 4 years old in 1938. Yeah. I'm about to have my 80th anniversary as a Broadway theater goer on October 19th this year.
Oh, great. And you're still going along to see Broadway musicals these days, or mainly
no.
when they get to Los Angeles?
No. No. I'm savoring my memories of the good ones.
Ah, great. What are your memories of the staging of Love Life in this unique vaudeville style?
Well, it was the sets were very light and very pretty. It was a very pretty show to look at, but they were, how can I say it? They were not sketchy, mm-hmm. but they had a lightness about them. And let's say, as in contrast to My Fair Lady, which is a big show with big, heavy sets and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And they were mobile or airy enough so that when a moral point was made, you could quickly move on, interrupted by the vaudeville act between each scene.
Yes.
You were able to move on to the next era in the lives of Samuel Cooper and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't necessarily miss the beauty of the previous set. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And each set very wonderfully captured the essence of the era. Some in the 1790s, some in the 1800s, some in the 1930s, and so on. But the show kept growing darker and darker because that was the whole point of it,
mm-hmm.
how modern society corrupts love life. And it wasn't the show that the public really wanted to hear at
mm-hmm.
that time.
Yes.
And that didn't help, unfortunately. America had been involved with a terrible war, as everybody in the world had.
Mm-hmm.
The war was just over in 1945, and suddenly here is a big, proud musical that is trying to point out to an audience successful in war, and now trying to survive in a post-war atmosphere, about the dangers of the very values that the country is supposed to espouse.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm.
And that was a difficult problem for a lot of people. Now, I was 14 years old, so it wasn't a problem for me because I wasn't trying to do anything except go to see a lot of shows and get good grades in school, so I didn't have to explain why I wasn't finishing my homework on time.
Yes.
But the show was just wonderful. I loved it. I loved all the little vaudeville sequences that took place, making commentary about the actions that we had just seen or were about to see. I mean, I remember economics and progress and so on. They were just wonderful and beautifully staged by Michael Kidd.
Yes, yes. I guess the format was more of a stage review rather than a stage musical, perhaps.
In a strange sort of way. I mean, in a review, of course, the themes or the sections of sketches and musical numbers aren't really related, except maybe in an abstract thematic way. Here, there was a dramatic line, but it was a show that was unlike anything that came before it or later.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say it's like something else, because it really wasn't like anything else. I'm appalled that nobody has made, I mean, with the love of Kurt Weill that is so pervasive in the world, I can't believe nobody has made a good quality studio recording of the whole thing. It's unbelievable.
Indeed.
I'm proud that I worked on, you know, an album that contains part of it, the Thomas Hampson album for EMI. but I wish it had been the whole score.
Indeed, yes. Well, we'll be listening to the excerpts from the Kurt Weill on Broadway album that John McGlynn was responsible for. And I believe John McGlynn himself did want to record it in full at some stage. Do you know anything about that?
Well, he wanted to record the complete Firebrand of Florence and the complete Love Life. And I know I was involved with all of his albums. I wrote the liner notes for almost all the albums. But maybe it was a question of getting the rights or something. Perhaps if you record only a few songs, you can just record them as individual songs. You don't have to get all the rights. But my God, he worked with the Kurt Weill estate in order to get the original orchestrations and the original arrangements and so on. So I don't quite understand. John was very secretive in some ways. He was not the easiest person with whom to work. And so he almost never shared his own methodology. I would hear what he was doing far too often without having any way of imposing, well, sometimes logic and reason, if I dare to say that. I could think of a few examples, but that's not on the subject of Love Life.
Yes, yes. Well, I have a friend who worked for EMI in London, and he said that he had a reputation for rubbing people up the wrong way. So
that's the polite way of putting it, but the British are so understated. I had a dear friend who, I really miss him terribly because I'm not writing these notes. So I don't even know what's happened. I don't even know if there's an EMI anymore. Don Kennedy, who edited all my liner notes. I don't know if there's any way that Don could ever hear this program, but if he can, Don, please know I miss talking to you. Long, long, long distance.
Ah, great. Well, we'll send a copy to you, and you can send a copy on to Don, too, I'm sure, if we can track him down.
Well, that would be nice. I mean, it's unbelievable to me that EMI seems to be out of business.
I believe it was taken over by Sony or one of those other big companies. They were bought out.
You know, this is sort of what Love Life is all about. I just don't understand the 21st century. Quite frankly, I have to tell you, I'm not finished with the 20th, you know. I'm writing with a 1929 Waterman's Patrician fountain pen, and it writes like a dream. And I have a Parker Vacuumatic from 1936. These are the pens with which I write, and somehow just touching them gives me an emotional contact with my world. My world has so little to do with the 21st century.
Yes.
And I can say that with a certain air of smugness because at 84, I seem to be in pretty good health. So far, I haven't required 21st century medication.
Well, you're not alone there, Miles. Even on this radio station, we have our nostalgia programs, which play music as far back as the 1920s. And, of course, we've got our fans in the 1950s as well, too. So,
I've been reading about your program, and it sounds wonderful. Are we able to hear it in Los Angeles?
Oh, certainly, yes, via the internet. But you'd have to get up at about 5 o'clock in the morning to hear it live. But
I go to bed at 5 o'clock in the morning. I could stay up a couple of extra hours.
Exactly.
To hear the Maid of the Mountains? Why not? I'm a big Lionel Monckton fan, but I never met him, of course.
Oh, great. Yes, well, I've featured the Arcadians and also Our Miss Gibbs and some of his other early musicals, too, on the program.
I knew the star of the Arcadians on Broadway, Julia Sanderson. She was a good friend.
Ah, great. Also,
she was married to Frank Crummett, and they did several shows together.
Yes, yes. And I believe she also introduced the song They Didn't Believe Me on Broadway.
Oh, of course.
Broadway.
She did indeed, with Donald Bryan and the girl from Utah. I was privileged to know a number of people who appeared on Broadway in the 19th century. Flora Zabel, who was the wife of Raymond Hitchcock, became a very dear friend of mine. Well, just so many people. Mae Murray, who was a silent film actress who never quite clarified her dates, but let me tell you, was on Broadway at the end of the 1890s.
Yes, yes.
A whole bunch of people. I knew people who made movies in the 19th century because I started being interested in all of this at a very, very young age. and there were loads of people around. Lee Whipper, L-E-I-G-H, Whipper, was a black man who was a character actor in mostly 1940s films.
Yes.
And I got to know Lee very well, and he told me how he had made a movie in Philadelphia, a fake newsreel of the Battle of San Juan Hill in 1898.
Extraordinary.
And I checked on it, and it's true. It was shot in Philadelphia. It was a fake newsreel, because they didn't make real newsreels in those days.
Yes, yes. Ah, great. Yes, I remember seeing a documentary and they reenacted a bombing of some battleship, which was all done with modelled ships back in the 1890s, and tried to pass
that off.
That's
what they did.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's what they did. They didn't know anything about real documentaries or newsreels. They didn't know any of that.
Uh-huh.
I also knew Whitford, Annabelle Whitford, who was known as Annabelle the Dancer. I think in the whole world she was the first person whose name as a performer in a film was actually identified.
Ah, uh-huh.
Do you remember she did skirt dance, sort of in the Louis Fuller style?
Yes, yes.
For Edison.
Oh, yes, I've seen some of those early Edison films on YouTube and various documentaries, yeah.
Well, in the late 1930s, we lived at 115th Street and Riverside Drive, down the hill from Columbia University, and I would go to the park with Grandpa,
mm-hmm.
and this lovely elderly lady would come over and chat with me and with other children,
mm-hmm.
and her name was Annabelle Whitford, and she was Annabelle the Dancer.
Oh, extraordinary.
And when I later grew up at the age of 8 as a sort of a mascot of the Museum of Modern Art, where I got to know everybody, I couldn't believe it when I saw her in a film.
Yeah. There you go. That elderly lady you used to speak to, and you saw her in her glory days. With her
so
dance.
What do I need the 21st century for?
Exactly. Well, we better steer the conversation back to Love Life, I guess.
Let's go back to Love Life.
Indeed, yes. Do you know whether there were any revivals? I believe there have been a few concert performances of Love Life since it was first staged, but have you seen or attended any concerts for Love Life? I believe at one stage you even thought that you'd like to revive the show yourself.
Well, in 1963, I used to visit Lerner in his office at the Waldorf Astoria. And Bud Whitney was my first friend in the theater. And he was a longtime assistant of Lerner. They met in Hollywood. One of Bud Whitney's grandparents or great-grandparents or some relation founded USC, the University of Southern California.
Yes.
And Bud was his assistant right back to the beginning, and often later did directed revivals of some of Alan's shows. And Bud and I were great pals. And he said, "Do you know anything about publicity?" And I said, "No, not particularly." He said, "Great, I've got a job for you." So around the summer of 1963, I became director of publicity for Alan J. Lerner.
Oh.
In the Waldorf Astoria.
Yes.
And I had the piano, I had the scripts. Alan gave me 3 working scripts of Love Life when the show was in different stages of completion. And I had all the sheet music and everything and the piano in my office.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with Love Life all over again. And we were sitting and having coffee in the office one day. And I said, "You know, I think about directing theater, and of all the musicals that ever have existed, the one I would like for which to direct a revival is Love Life."
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he looked very troubled, and he said, "I can never allow that show to be revived." And I said, "Why?" "Because I have turned into everything I satirized in that show." Those were Alan's exact, precise words.
Yeah.
And now, of course, ironically, the estates of Kurt Weill and Alan J. Lerner would be delighted if anybody produced a revival,
uh-huh.
even though you're not supposed to violate what they wanted.
Yes.
I don't know how Kurt Weill felt about it. I only knew Lenya, who was a good friend, but I never met Kurt Weill.
Uh-huh.
But Alan never wanted the show revived.
Uh-huh.
And here we are talking across an ocean about love life.
Indeed, yes. Well, my guest, Michael Levine, has been sitting back patiently. Michael, would you like to put a few questions to Miles about love life?
Yes, Miles, I was wondering, did you talk to Latilenia about love life and her memories of it?
I didn't talk about her memories of it so much. I talked about my memories of it.
I mean, did she have an opinion? Did she have an opinion of the show? Did she have an opinion about the show?
Did she have an opinion?
About whether it worked or whether she liked it or anything?
Well, she seemed to like everything Kurt Wilde did. I'll tell you something she told me. She said, Wilde was so thrilled to be out of Europe. He sensed the horror of what was coming. And he told her, and she related it to me, that when they arrived in New York City in 1935, he said to her, I no longer want to be called Kurt Weill. I want to have my name pronounced the American way,
wow.
Kurt Weill. But of course, Lenya's accent was so heavy there wasn't any distinction between when she said, I didn't want to be pronounced Kurt Weill, I only wanted to be Kurt Weill.
Right. I mean, what do you think the average American, the average person in the world says today?
I think Kurt Weill. I don't think they say Kurt Weill.
They didn't know that Kurt preferred
Weill. I guess if you're discussing Dreyfus and Oprah or one of the European pieces,
certainly
it's appropriate to say Kurt Weill. I grew accustomed to saying Kurt Weill because he became sort of an American.
Right, as I find it fascinating, the difference between his German shows and his Broadway musicals. His Broadway musicals have a whole different sound to them, and sound so Broadway, whereas the German musicals are so
starting with really Lady in the Dark, and then of course One Touch of Venus, and certainly Love Life. You're quite right. I quite agree with you, and Street Scene, for goodness sake. It's like the work of a totally different composer.
And even within Street Scene, because you have Lonely House, but you also have Wouldn't You Like to Be on Broadway or Moonface Starry Eye, the real Broadway up-tempos, and then a real
Absolutely.
Classic ballad like Lonely House. But also, I feel like, I wonder what Lerner would think, knowing that there's all this interest in Love Life now. Would he just poo-poo it and go, oh, no, don't, please don't do it? Like, I know there was a concert in Philadelphia around 30 years ago with the former Debbie Shapiro, who's now Debbie Gravitt, of Love Life, and I had some friends in it, and there's a tape floating around of that performance, which I think was with an orchestra, and it was full. Do you know about that?
No, I know nothing about it.
I can ask some friends who were in that, because I know there was a recording, not a recording, but there are some bootleg recordings of that production. And working on the songs, Rob asked me to record the 7, I believe, songs that had not been recorded before. And they're fascinating. And as I said to you earlier, is it him or is it me? It reminds me of I'm a Stranger Here Myself. It just has the nice swing and the minor key. And they're really witty. I mean, Lerner, I think, at his best, seriously, the lyrics I knew already, like Mr. Right, which I love. I mean, we'll be hearing these tonight.
Well, yes, Mr. Wright is terrific, and I can hear Nan singing it. She was just wonderful. I wonder if any of the three children who were the Tots are still living. I have no idea.
Well, I guess we can look it up. But I also think like something like O Billy O, which is this close harmony, five-part harmony or six-part harmony number that's apparently done a cappella originally, and it's the top of the second act, and it just kind of sets the mood and tells, but it's clever lyrics, intricate rhyming, and I just think this is a fascinating, and this 60-page minstrel show sequence towards the end of the show that just fascinating. That's the key word I keep using for it, fascinating.
It was an adventure to watch the show because you had no idea whatsoever what was going to happen next, and I think that upset Brooks Atkinson and perhaps a few other critics. But I guess when I was 14, my brain was more flexible. I was thrilled by the adventure of it.
Well, how early in your relationship with Alan J. Lerner did you bring up Love Life to him?
Oh, probably the first day. Well, not quite the first day. That was in Herman Levin's office.
Right.
But when I was director of publicity for him, we talked about it all the time.
Did he look at you and roll his eyes the first time you brought it up to him?
Yes, of course.
Right. But then you said, no, but I remember it and I loved it. I was 14. He probably rolled his eyes again, right? But
he knew how much I loved her. He wouldn't have given me three scripts.
Right. And the three scripts are different. They really made that many changes on the show.
They're somewhat different from each other, yes. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Now, I would compare it to something like Hallelujah Baby, which does a very, very similar thing in time, going through time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the characters, same thing, having one set of characters, a family, going through 100 years. Hallelujah Baby does the exact same thing, I think exactly 20 years after Love Life. But it was Arthur Lawrence's creation.
Well, yes. Now, I just wonder if Rosalie Alter, Glenn Gale, and Vincent Gugliotti are still alive.
I'll have to look
they
them
were
up.
The children. They must have been around my age, because they weren't really tough.
So they could be around, yeah.
I'm they gonna... were maybe 12 or 13 or something like that. I was 14, and I'm around. And I don't think they were older than I.
Right. We'll try to figure it out. I'm going to put you back to Rob now.
Well, it's just a pleasure to share a little bit of the memories of Love Life. Knowing you were going to telephone me today inspired me to look at the playbill. I have some out-of-town playbills from Boston, which have a couple of different songs and songs in different locations in the plot.
Mm, yes.
And the souvenir program has wonderful photographs, and they helped revive my memory of it. So I'm deeply grateful, and I wish you great success with your program. I'd love to have a copy of it when you're finished.
Oh, certainly, yes. We'll send you a copy when we're done. Yes, we will be hearing one cut song, which featured on a 1956 album. Alan J. Lerner performs his own songs on lyrics by Lerner with Kay Ballard and Billy Taylor. And there's a song called Susan's Dream featuring Kay Ballard that we shall hear at the end of the program too. So,
well, that's terrific. Susan's Dream, yes, it's a wonderful song. I wonder why they cut it. It wasn't in it in Boston, because I had the Boston programs. So I don't know when it was cut. I just know it wasn't in the show in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, it was probably cut in rehearsals, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't have the first week. I think it opened on the 13th of September in Boston. I have a September 20th and a September, I think, 27th program. So it could have been cut the first week in Boston.
All right. So ideally, we'd like to have a fully commercial recording of the full score plus all the cut songs, but perhaps this program might do something to help inspire that dream.
Good. Well, you're inspiring people to do it. So it's a great joy to be part of your tribute to that remarkable, singular musical. Brings back great memories.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time, Miles. It's been a delight speaking to you, and no doubt we'll speak again in the future, too, about some
good.
Of your
Well, thank your you,
memories.
Rob, and thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Great. Bye for now.
Bye.